Hi, I'm Valerie, and you're listening to The Beauty Brains. Welcome to The Beauty Brains, a show where real cosmetic chemists answer your beauty product questions and give you an insider's look at the cosmetics industry. This is episode 208. I'm your host, Valerie George, and with me today is my co-host, Perry Romanowski.
Hey, Valerie!
How's it going?
Oh, it's good. I'm drinking some tea that has tepid water, but I'm looking forward to the show.
I'm drinking tea with hot water, and I'm also looking forward to the show. On today's program, we're going to talk about, of course, a couple news stories that came up and answer your questions about, is there a bar shampoo or bar conditioner that works as well as the ones out of a bottle? Why can't everyone use retinol? Is sugaring dangerous? And does it work as well as waxing? And finally, do peptides have an effect beyond moisturizing, and is there a best one to pick? Are you ready?
I am ready for that. Hey, I like to do a little bit of inane chit-chat before we start, but you know what I did last Friday?
What'd you do?
My wife and I went to a spa for 2 hours.
Oh, wow. How was it? Was it your first spa experience?
No, I've actually been to this place before. It's more of a bathhouse than a spa, I guess. But essentially, you go in there, you know, you're wearing swim trunks or whatever, and they have a salt pool where you can float, and then they have music in the water so you can hear it. Then there's whirlpools and steam rooms and cold plunges.
Wow.
But I bring this up because they had a big salt lick, although I don't think you're supposed to lick it, but it was this gigantic mound of salt, and then you're supposed to... I guess exfoliate with it, so rub it all over your body, and then rinse it off. And I did that, and boy, my skin felt very very smooth.
Oh wow, very cool.
The big problem with it though was that all the salt kept getting stuck in my chest hairs. I think I still have some in there.
Really?
Yeah, it's awful. When I was working at Alberto, we had bought the St. Ives brand, and so we had the St. Ives apricot scrub.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was given, at the company, everybody was given a sample, and the president was out there, and she's like, hey, you all should use this product. This is a great product. Here, I want everybody to use it. I'm giving everybody a sample. And I used it, and the little walnut shells were stuck in my chest hair and were there for, like, weeks. I can't exfoliate.
Oh, my gosh.
Hey, I'm looking forward to seeing you coming up this weekend.
Yeah, I can't believe you're coming to LA. For those of you who didn't listen to last week's episode, Perry is coming to Los Angeles for Green Beauty Night, which is an event put on by another podcast called The Eco Well, and he'll be on a panel. And I live in LA, so I'm super excited that Perry's coming to town.
Yeah, that'll be fun. I think that's on Saturday. I'll put a link to that event in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll probably do an Instagram Live or a little get together, maybe at a hotel bar or something like that. So stay tuned to our Instagram account where we will make that announcement if you're in the LA area.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Speaking of fun, how about some beauty science news?
Let's do it.
Well, Valerie, I'll take this one. I saw this story in Cosmetics Design where they were interviewing one of the regulatory people at the Cosmetics Europe, and he was saying that the cosmetic industry needs to take a holistic approach to explaining ingredient safety.
Oh.
He makes some claims that while the cosmetics industry is extensively regulated, which I thought was kind of funny, but he does preface it by saying, especially in Europe, he says that there continues to be consumer concern over certain ingredients that are actually perfectly safe. So that's just for consumers. That is the view from people inside the industry and these ingredients that we use. I mean, if you're going to be honest about the safety information, the ingredients we use them at safe levels. And that's what the scientists and the regulators in the industry think. Now, the marketers don't always think that, right?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting because usually you hear this sentiment that, oh, consumers in the U.S. don't think products are safe. They're so much safer in Europe. And here's this guy who's the head of Cosmetics Europe. He's saying that consumers there aren't thinking products are safe. despite the fact that they do have safety. So it's interesting that even with such quote unquote extensive regulation, people still have this perception that what they have isn't safe. That's interesting.
Exactly. And first he blames a few things, the rise of digital media, and he says that it's the goal of the EU regulators to address this problem in the coming years. And then he goes on to say that one of the problems are these product scanning apps, for example. He says that they were, quote, a little misleading and unduly alarming.
Oh, like the app, like Think Dirty or something like that?
Yes, those kind of apps that where you can scan the thing and it'll tell you if there's some sort of dirty ingredient in it. But those weren't put together by people who know toxicology. Those are put together by fearmongers. So he says that the industry needs to do a better job of explaining to consumers how synthetic chemicals are not inherently more dangerous than natural ones. And he thinks that if we take a holistic approach to explain why ingredients in cosmetics are safe, that is going to help reassure consumers. I have to say, the guy seems a lot more optimistic than me.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, I think there are a few, he touches on a few reasons that consumers are misinformed, but I think there are a few more important reasons why the problem of chemophobia propagates. I blame it on a few things. First, there's the cosmetic marketers.
Amen.
Yeah, I mean, truly, like the small and the new companies, you know, they can't make products that work better than the products that big corporation makes. Now, they can make products that work pretty much just as good or good enough, right? But they don't have access to the same like R&D or time or consumer testing. They just don't have that ability. And so when you can't make a product that works as well as a competitor, you have to find some other way to compete. They also can't compete in terms of advertising, like P&G, L'Oreal, Unilever. Those guys have a ton of money to spend on TV commercials to build up their brands. Small brands just don't have that, so they rely a lot more on social media. And well, the main way that you get attention on social media is that you say controversial things, right? Telling the people that ingredients in their competitors' products cause cancer is pretty much an effective way to get people to not use those products.
Well, I think cosmetic marketers, it doesn't exist only at smaller new companies. I will say that even at large companies, these organizations have excellent marketing departments because marketing sells products, even if it's not, the truth. That's why we exist, to really tell you about the science behind your beauty products. But, yeah. The cosmetic marketer thing, it's at all companies, and it's a worldwide staffing perspective, I'll say, that companies have. Like, even, I was working with an R&D lab in Europe at one time, and even they were like, ugh, the marketing team. And so I was like, that's so good to know that this battle between R&D, who I think are like the truth seekers, and marketing exists worldwide. It was pretty funny.
I completely agree that this is a problem with both small companies and big companies. The next thing that I think is there's the problem of the media. Mm-hmm. Similarly, stories about products that are causing cancer or otherwise scaring people are much more interesting than those that tell the truth. But, I mean, which article would you read? Say the headline is your baby shampoo causing cancer? Or the headline is, baby shampoo continues to be perfectly safe. You're just not going to click on the one that says everything's fine.
Boring.
Right. And then there's places like Netflix who put out these scary documentaries like The Goop Lab or their other awful one, Stink. And they sort of get more attention than sort of less provocative series like A User's Guide to Cheating Death. Because fear just attracts more attention in a way that truth-telling doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there are the pseudo-experts. Anyone can write anything about anything on the internet, and they can get attention. I mean, actual experts get drowned out by people who are more effective communicators on social media. Scientists are also busy in the lab doing science, so they don't necessarily have time to get on social media and publish consistent content, which is really required to build a fan base. I mean, if you want to do social media right, you really have to dedicate a lot of time to it.
Yeah, and when you're doing that, you're not doing science. I will say the other thing about experts being able to come out and speak the truth is I do a lot of work during the day, and there's only so much I can share just because I'm not privileged to discuss everything I'm doing. So everything I personally publish on social media has to be my own work, has to be on my own time. So that's challenging too. And there are a lot of chemists who work at companies with really strict social media policy. So really a lot of the independent scientists you see are independent scientists speaking to work.
Absolutely. Actually, the Beauty Brains, when we started, Randy and I both worked at a company, and the company would not have approved us doing the Beauty Brains. In fact, we used to write articles for trade journals, how-to stuff for other cosmetic chemists in the industry. No secrets or anything. And we had to run all of those by our management before they would even get published. So when you work for a company, you are not necessarily free to say whatever you want.
All views my own and not that of my employer. I have a disclaimer on pretty much everything I do.
It is interesting that that Instagram site Estee Laundry and how they sort of maintain an anonymity. They probably work for a company that wouldn't allow them to do that.
Yeah, at least not what they're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So just to wrap this up, you know, what can the industry do? I don't really know. I'd say the most important thing would be for industry brands to stop propagating BS that they know is fake. I mean, all these clean beauty brands are really harming the industry. And unfortunately, I see the big companies starting to do this too.
Ugh.
What really needs to happen is that consumers have to stop falling for these sensational stories too. They need to stop supporting brands that participate in fear marketing. Your cosmetics are not harming you, and brands who claim to be the clean brands, they're just not safer for you than the brands that don't claim that. All right, Valerie, I'm off my soapbox there.
All right. I basically agree with what you said. Well, I found an interesting story this week. Scientists discover UV protection may not be enough to prevent sun damage.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so pretty much if you walk on planet Earth and you exist as a human being, you may know that the sun can damage your skin. It can burn it. It can cause blisters. It can cause skin cancer, all that kind of stuff. So we all know that you need to have some sort of sun protection, even going back even into historic times. We covered ourselves from the sun. We protected ourselves from its rays. You know, heat is tiring and exhausting and all that kind of stuff. So no news there. But scientists at Newcastle University in the UK did a study where they looked at all the components of the sun's rays. So not just ultraviolet light, but visible light and infrared light, and found that it also damaged the skin. So a lot of skincare brands provide products for ultraviolet protection, which helps prevent wrinkles, pigmentation, burning. But they say it may be beneficial if your product also has products that can protect against infrared light and visible light, because they found that while it didn't damage the top layer of the skin's dermis layer, cells in the dermis layer were damaged by visible and infrared light as well. So you didn't see stuff on the top, but you saw it in the bottom, and it's not good.
Wow, so these guys are saying that UV protection is no longer enough. Now you need visible and ultra-visible protection too.
Visible and infrared, right.
Ah,
so while those don't cause sunburn and they're not known directly to be a skin cancer risk, they do cause other detriments such as premature aging, uneven skin tone, loss of elasticity, and all that. So yeah, they just recommend cover yourself pretty much. I mean, just practice sun safety, be sun smart, get out of the sun, wear sunglasses.
Or stay in your house or live in a cave.
Yeah. So I wonder, I've seen infrared pop up every now and again. And I know that within the last 10 years, there have been a ton of studies, at least on visible light and hair damage. But yeah, just interesting. I wonder if we'll start to see more products pop up that aren't just about UV or pollution, but UV, visible, infrared, like all these light sources. I know we're seeing blue light a lot already, which comes from your
blue light,
your computer screen or your iPad or whatever. But
yeah, or this LED light on my microphone here. Oh.
Yeah.
No wonder I have that spot on my cheek.
Yeah, not a big story, but just something I thought, are we going to start to see more products popping up, or at least more research being done in this area?
Yeah, look for that in 2020.
Yeah, let's get to some questions.
Look, Valerie, we have an audio question.
Hey, Perry and Valerie. I'm Jennifer from Oregon. It's becoming increasingly important to me to seek out beauty products that incorporate minimal packaging. When it comes to hair care, I've tried bars, both made locally and the Ethique brand available at Target and on Amazon. Neither performed well on my coarse, wavy hair. My question is it wishful thinking to hope for a bar shampoo or conditioner that is going to leave my hair as well as conventional products packaged in a plastic bottle? Do you know of any brands that I might try that don't come in a plastic bottle? Thank you, and I look forward to your response.
All right, Jennifer, thanks so much for asking that question. We actually talked about the chemistry of solid bar shampoos and conditioners back on episode 178. You can go back and listen to that to get a more in-depth discussion.
That was one of our earlier Together podcasts.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think, too, that's when we started to see these solid bars pop back up. Basically, these formulas use the same ingredients as standard formulas, but with a lot less water. Lush is a big purveyor of the solid shampoo bars, and they use sodium lauryl sulfate as their main solid detergent. They also have some other formulas, which include sodium laureth sulfate, which is an ethoxylated version of SLS, disodium laureth sulfosuccinate. Another popular ingredient in these bar shampoos is sodium cocoyl isethionate. These are all standard shampoo ingredients that you would find in a traditional shampoo in a bottle, and you could also find them in the bars.
Yeah, I saw another shampoo bar that was also based on sodium cocoate, which that's more of a soap.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to work very well on hair. So,
yeah. The benefit about these formulas is that they do come in plastic-free containers. So typically you're just buying the actual product, which I think is their main attribute. If you're looking for them because you're going to get different types of ingredients, I don't think that you're going to get that because they're using the same detergents that are used in regular shampoos. And I don't think you're going to get a performance benefit from that route.
Yeah, it's just kind of harder to deliver from that solid, right? It's
not, yeah.
The liquid's just so much easier to spread through your hair.
Yeah, when you're formulating these types of shampoos, you are working really hard to get them solubilized. Like SLS, sodium cocoyl isethionate, they don't easily go into water. They have very low solubilities. And so it's a lot of work to try to get them in water and to stay in there. And so to me, and I've used a lot of shampoo bars in my day to try them because I do like the plastic-free context that they offer. It's really hard to take a small piece in your hand and to effectively solubilize it in the water and then work it through the hair. I think in that way, they don't work as well as traditional shampoos because partially of that. I don't know what the exact measurements are, but when you take a couple pumps of a shampoo and put it in your hand, yeah, you're getting more water in there, but the ingredients are also effectively incorporated and you can work that through your hand into your hair very easily. If you have this shampoo bar, you're pretty much only working with solids, and I don't think you can effectively deliver them over the hair.
Yeah, I mean, and the way you use it, I guess, I mean, the way I use these things is what I'd rub it on my hands,
mm-hmm.
create some foam there, and then spread that foam through my hair. I mean, at that point, you've really diluted it by a lot. I don't really know exactly what the measurement would be, but I'd guess you're probably getting probably 10 times less ingredients using a bar shampoo versus a squeeze bottle.
And not only less ingredients, but just less effective distribution. And sort of the same thing for a solid conditioner. I actually think solid conditioners, like if you gave me a choice, like you have to use a shampoo or a conditioner in a solid form, hands down, I would choose the shampoo, because we need to clean our hair, but the solid conditioners I find really, really don't work. So for a solid conditioner, they typically are similar formula types, except they incorporate things like cocoa butter, shea butter, and other conditioning ingredients that you may find in a conventional conditioner like Bahin Trimonium Chloride. They also do contain surfactants so that you can help rinse the stuff from your hair. Part of the conditioning thing is like getting on and incorporating it, but then you also need to make them rinseable. And when you have a lot of these oils or butters, they just don't rinse easily from the hair. I've also found that you can't put too much conditioning agents into the bar format. It's a formula limitation.
Oh, yeah.
And two, distribution is really important. When you have a traditional conditioner, you have this oil and water emulsion, and you have really tiny particle size, and those distribute really well over the length of the whole hair fiber and allow really even deposition of these cationic conditioning agents. And with the solid conditioner, it's just very hard to get that. Additionally, in a conditioner, you want to use ingredients like silicones that really help improve the hair feel and the experience. And if they're functionalized, silicones offer an additional benefit, and you really can't put those in the solid shampoo bars. Yeah. But again, if you're looking at these solids from a plastic-free benefit, if that's really important to you, go that route. But I just don't think that they work as well from a functional point of view as a shampoo or conditioner conventional bottle.
I don't think they ever will. I think it's just a technological limitation. It's not so much something that formulators just haven't figured out. My prediction is that the format just does not lend itself very well to good the same kind of performance that you get from a liquid.
Exactly. Yeah. And two, I have used a lot of these again, and I've left them in my shower, and they're not shower friendly. You got to be able to store them in a good place. They kind of, ooze over time.
You know what you need? You need like a plastic container where you can just put it in.
You're bad. Well, what do we have next?
Our next question comes to us from Amy. Amy says, "Hi, Beauty Brains, love your podcast and watching my friends get angry as I debunk their crazy claims." "I worked in cosmetics for years, and it's crazy the scripts we'd be given to push products. Thank goodness for science-based, reliable info like yours. The question is, why can't all skin types acclimate to retinoids or Retin-A? I've tried everything, easing into it, and I'm just getting nothing but irritation. I'm 55 and would love to be using it, you know, because it's proven to work, but I've just had no luck. Thanks for keeping it real."
Oh, thanks so much, Amy. You know, I'm in your camp. I have rosacea, and I can't use these types of ingredients either. And that actually was my dermatologist's recommendation to stay away from them. Yeah. So I'm super sad because, they do really work, and I'm very jealous of people who do get to use them.
Yeah. Yeah. But before we get to answering, I just want to apologize for causing any problem with your friends. but, you know, sometimes reality is much less appealing than these marketing stories. Let's talk a little bit about retinoids. Retinoic acid, also known as Retin-A or triretinoin, and sometimes you'll find it as the brand Accutane. That's a prescription drug used to treat acne. And while that's its primary function, dermatologists also prescribe it for things like evening out your complexion and reducing fine lines and wrinkles. This makes it one of the most valuable anti-aging ingredients. However, retinoic acid is not available in any cosmetic because it can only be purchased with a prescription from your doctor. Now, on the other hand, retinol is not a prescription drug. It is the alcohol form of retinoic acid. That means they're chemically related, and it does have some similar skin refining properties. However, because it's the alcohol form, it's not nearly as effective as the acid. And neither are other derivatives that you might see as retinoids like retinaldehyde or retinyl palmitate. Those are generally ingredients that have been chemically modified. So you start with a retinoic acid, you chemically modify it to make it less irritating. Unfortunately, that makes it less effective. And another problem with retinol is that it's not very stable, and it's easily oxidized. Formulating with it is pretty tough.
Yeah, it is. That means that exposure to oxygen, light, or even other ingredients in the same formula can render this ingredient even less effective because they're reacting with it, and then it is either changed and not available to work as it's intended.
Of course, Valerie, that also means that less effective probably means that it's going to be less irritating, so maybe that's a plus. But as far as irritation goes, first, I don't really have an answer to why some skin types can tolerate retinoids and others can't. You know, it could be a combination of a bunch of things, like genetics, environment, your personal pain tolerance level. There probably isn't really just one simple answer. But as far as what you might be able to try, I would say the less effective retinoids are also going to be less irritating. So, you know, you might start with those things and see if you get any benefit. And I'd also suggest that you use a lower level at the start. You might consider mixing your retinol lotion with some similar non-retinol containing lotion so you could dilute your exposure. And also, they say that putting it on dry skin can help reduce problems.
Yeah, when you buy these products with retinol, they typically tell you what the use level is. I actually wouldn't buy a product that doesn't disclose the level. A really good brand that's done their diligence will disclose the level to you so that you know what you're being exposed to and what the level is. So you could buy like 0.25%, 0.5%, 1%. And such. So that's what Perry's talking about in using different levels.
Yeah, and generally lower levels are going to be less irritating and you know, less harsh on your skin. Ultimately, though, for some people, they just can't use some ingredients. I
mean, like
it's the
me.
Same with yeah, like you.
Like it's poor like, old Valerie can't use retinol. First world problem.
You can't use nutmeg either, can you?
Cinnamon, nutmeg, clove, ginger. Yeah.
Man, that is so sad. I was grocery shopping and they had in the bargain bin all the pumpkin spice holiday pudding. And I've just been buying boxes and boxes of it.
That would kill me. That's my kryptonite. If I were Superman, that's my kryptonite.
Oh, yeah. My wife finds my love of pudding to be just terrible.
Yeah, I don't think like, that's a good pudding flavor.
She's like, that's baby food. Well, I love pumpkin spice pudding. Anyway, unfortunately.